This is In the Court of Public Opinion, a program that shows you how media and public perception affects us all. Your host is Jim Haggerty. Now, back to this week's program.
We are back in the Court of Public Opinion. I'm Jim Haggerty. Now we turn to another member of the media who also dives deep into legal issues in ways that most don't. Daniel Fisher, senior editor of Forbes magazine, who covers legal affairs, corporate finance, macroeconomics, and occasionally sailing for Forbes. He also writes the Full Disclosure blog on Forbes.com. Dan was the Southwest Bureau Manager for Forbes in Houston from 1999 to 2003. Before that, he worked for Bloomberg Business News in Houston, the Dallas Times-Herald, and the Houston Post. After his time in Texas, he returned home to his native Connecticut for a night fellowship at Yale Law School. He's also a chartered financial analyst, interestingly enough. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Hi.
I have to ask you, you were kind of a Connecticut Yankee down in Texas for a while. How did that come about?
Well, it was kind of accidental and kind of sailing, actually. I mean, it's a long story, but basically I wanted to move to a warmer climate after getting my first newspaper job in Wisconsin, and my wife, who wanted to go to med school and whose mother is from Texas, got an opportunity to go down there, and I said, let's go. So I ended up in Texas entirely on spec.
Wow. And you also started off doing financial stuff and became more of a legal affairs reporter. How did you find yourself going in that direction?
Well, I migrated to business reporting first, and it was partly strategic, partly because I found it interesting. I'm just an English major and didn't know anything about business when I started. I found it interesting, but also I found that it was a niche. The level of sophistication was going up. The Wall Street Journal used to be the only place that really had sophisticated financial coverage, and I saw that right. In the average newspaper, you know, the business editor was the burned out alcoholic former sports editor, and it was kind of a repository for the failures. And that was a great opportunity. So when I got to Dallas, I started taking classes in finance and accounting, and found it very interesting, started doing more and more business writing, and kept running up against the law everywhere I turned. And so it became clear that you needed to know the law in order to know business. And that's how I got going with it. It was originally just writing stories about legal issues, and I was kind of fumbling in the dark, relying on legal experts to explain things to me.
I mean, that's probably even more the case today, right, that you need to understand the law to understand anything about business.
Well, especially once you do a year of law school like I did, then the light kind of goes on and you start seeing all the stuff you didn't understand. You know, classic example at Bloomberg, companies used to just jump through a million hoops to say that it was a merger of equals, and we would go, that's ridiculous, and we'd do a simple calculation and say company A is buying company B, and they would go nuts and they would call back and complain. It was only when I got to Yale Law School and took a Biz Orge law class that I understood that this was very important under Delaware law for them to maintain this fictional merger of equals status. But it made no sense in the capital markets, but it was helpful to understand why they were so worked up about it.
Why exactly they were doing it. And that's some of the... Now, you were also a night fellow at Yale. What is that?
That was a wonderful program where the Knight Foundation, which is the old Knight Ritter newspaper family, you could get a free year of Yale Law School. Linda Greenhouse of the Times was one of the first students, and every year they would pick 3 to 5 mid-career journalists. I hate to say I closed 2 newspapers and a fellowship program because that 2 newspapers that I worked for failed shortly after I left them, and this program I was, I think, in one of the last years for it. But it was fantastic. You got a free year of Yale Law School. The first semester you had to take all the mandatory courses, which was essential. A lot of these programs you just take electives. That wouldn't work with the law. You have to take civil procedure. You have to take con law, as you know. And then the second semester you could take electives. And so it was just a wonderful program, one of the most fun things I've ever done.
And what do you dislike? You obviously like diving into these legal issues. What do you dislike about it?
About the law, almost nothing. I find it fascinating. It's just, you know, when I got to Yale Law, I realized it's slow-motion democracy. It's the same process, but it just operates at a much slower speed, and it's less responsive to sort of immediate pressures. But it's fascinating. It's why people do what they do. It's how society is ordered. It's how business is ordered. I'll tell you, the one thing that really irritates me about the law, and it's sort of structural, is judges who have very little respect for what we journalists do. Mm-hmm. Judges tend to think that their courts are sort of this private preserve where they control everything. And they do control most things.
Right, right.
My civil procedure professor, Harold Coe, reminded us that there's the rules of civil procedure and then there are the local court rules. And the local court rules are the first thing you must focus on.
Yeah, yeah.
But judges do not control the disclosure of information. They do not get to just willy-nilly seal files.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah.
I think, the most irritating thing is you go down to the courthouse and they've sealed files, and it's ridiculous. And they do not have the power to do that at just a whim.
Right, right. And very often they seal them not necessarily for confidential information, but because it's embarrassing or they don't want the disclosure or they don't want the interference of the public knowing about what's going on, right?
Yeah, they feel like it would disrupt their operation of the court, and to which I say, sorry, I'm paying for the court, you know?
Right, I mean,
you work for me, yeah. You don't work for yourself. So I think that is, as a journalist, that's the most irritating thing.
Yeah, and there's been, I haven't seen any studies on it, but there's been a growth in the sealing of court documents. At least anecdotally, I've heard that over the past couple of years. Have you experienced that?
Yeah, I don't try to crack open too many cells, but I think that's mostly in settlements. And again, that's sort of symptomatic of, I don't know, my wife's a doctor, and there's a terrible term that they use in emergency rooms. They call certain patients gomers, and it means get out of my emergency room. I think a lot of judges treat a lot of high-stakes civil litigation as get out of my courtroom. Like, if you reach a settlement and one of the conditions is everything is sealed up and out of public view, fine with me. I just want it off my plate.
Right, right. It just moves the case along, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, another thing in the public relations field I've seen recently is a plaintiff will file a complaint under seal and say, look, this is very embarrassing to the defendant, and unless we get a settlement, we're going to have to unseal this and use it as almost a tactic. Have you ever
There's a more unkind word that springs to mind. It begins with E.
Yes.
Called extortion.
Yes, I mean, it's very much, it's an attempt to very much sort of say, we're going to pull the sheet off this if you don't knuckle under, you know? But again,
yeah,
if judges are willing to seal everything that comes their way, that tactic works.
Yeah, so that's, I don't think that's should be allowed.
Yeah, and it gets to a major theme of what I do, which is that this explosion of media and information has changed the law and legal practice, and the judicial system has to change with it. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it's a good thing. I think maybe self-importantly, I think journalists like me and better journalists out there, by getting training in the law, we're actually just doing to the law what we did to business. There's Forbes, mm-hmm. again, self-importantly deemed itself years ago the drama critic of American business. Point being,
right.
Business, you know, the Delaware court system is pretty good in some ways at disciplining executives that run amok and standing up for the rights of shareholders, but the press has a really important role to play in disciplining business. I think the press has an important role to play in disciplining the legal system, particularly when it comes to class actions.
Right.
You know, this is a business. It's an industry. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry.
Right.
And it desperately needs critical analysis by journalists. The Nutella settlement recently. The lawyers get $3.5 million for the brilliant legal work of apparently determining that Nutella isn't part of a healthy breakfast. I mean, it's a joke. It's a
right.
sick joke. Nobody should make a penny off of that. The consumers pay for it, and there should be more reporting to reflect that. That this is not a cute game. This is not boys being boys. This is costly, and it's wrong.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think there's a role for the press in that, just as the press criticized business practices that were not in shareholders' interests.
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right. Well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to take a short break and come back and actually talk more about this, because you've hit on a very good point there.
Okay.
This is Jim Haggerty. You're in the Court of Public Opinion. We'll be right back after this message.
In the information economy, effective communication can mean the difference between success and failure. PRCG Strategic Communications is an internationally known leader in litigation public relations, crisis communications, and high-level reputation counseling. PRCG was founded on the principle that clients want personalized, hands-on service delivered by experienced advisors who understand your business, your mission, and your goals. PRCG counselors have a long history of working closely with major clients facing sensitive, highly complex communications challenges. PRCG has also worked for more than 15 years on assignments in the environmental, recycling, and sustainable business arenas. When your company's reputation is on the line, call the best. For more information about PRCG Strategic Communications, visit PRCG.com. This is In the Court of Public Opinion, a program that shows you how media and public perception affects us all. Your host is Jim Haggerty. Now, back to this week's program.
We're back in the Court of Public Opinion. This is Jim Haggerty. We've been speaking with Dan Fisher, a senior editor at Forbes who covers legal affairs. Dan, before the break, we were talking about the disciplining function of media on our judicial system. I've never really heard anyone speak about it that way. But it's a great point for both business and for plaintiffs, right?
Yeah, I think it's an important role, but it requires knowledge of the law to do it. It's actually a waste of time to just nag like I just did before the break about class action settlements. People just get sick of hearing it. It's just like nag about executive pay.
Right.
But
if
you apply legal knowledge to it and point out where the lawyers or the judges are abusing a particular form of law or not following the rules of procedure, I think you have more punch that way.
Yeah. And why do so few in the media take that kind of in-depth look that helps people really understand what's going on?
I think, again, I don't want to flatter myself too much, but I'll tell you about my own ignorance about the law. When I went to Yale Law, I did not know the difference, for example, between statutory and common law.
Right.
I did not know basic things about the law that you need to know just to understand who's doing what in the system. I didn't know the fundamental principles of how constitutional law evolved. And so I think without that knowledge, it all looks very murky, and you can't figure out where to even get started. And
right.
The lawyers certainly aren't going to be helpful in that pursuit.
Right. And what you wind up doing is or what a lot of reporters wind up doing is you know, this side says one thing, the other side says the other, and we'll see.
Well, and the favorite tactic of plaintiff lawyers in particular, the defense lawyers are good at this too, is they're going to hand a bunch of beautiful tidbits to the reporter. And reporters, you know, we live for juicy facts.
Right.
And good lawyers, it's all about facts. They can assemble facts into something that is so far from the truth that it's unbelievable. But reporters live for that. So they'll get a handful of facts that make a good story, but the problem is there might be a glaring flaw in the actual case. I'm struggling for an example, but one that always comes to mind, and this is where I really cut my teeth in legal writing, was with the breast implant litigation.
Uh-huh.
And I started out sort of on the side of the plaintiffs, and the lawyers certainly were giving me all kinds of juicy stuff. And then about partway through, I realized this is like the case of somebody who repeatedly was speeding through a school zone,
mm-hmm.
but never hurt anybody, never hit anybody. And yet you had this massive amount of litigation against the manufacturers of breast implants for failing to fully test the product, but the dirty little secret was there was no problem with it other than they ruptured. And the women who had legitimate medical bills from ruptured implants were getting screwed in the name of this larger settlement that would pay women who had no problems at all. And the whole unjustness of it really struck me, and that's where I got involved. And I wanted to understand how this could happen. How could something this horrible happen? And that's really what got me interested.
Yeah, and what I've discovered is that there's almost a litigation industrial complex out there where neither side has any incentive to settle until the plaintiffs have gotten the case far enough along that they're getting fees somehow based on the work they did, and that the defense has gotten far enough along that they've made some fees off the defendant.
Yeah, it sort of heads in that direction, and then the judges knock heads together. That's certainly what happened in the implant litigation, as I realized that we had a judge down in Alabama, I believe, and he just wanted a settlement. He wanted to bring them together to a settlement, and as a journalist on the sidelines, I'm going, well, wait a second. You know, these lawyers are saying that this silicone is a slow-acting poison that's killing women, yet they've negotiated a settlement where all the benefits go away after 7 years.
Right.
What happens to the woman in year 20 with this slow-acting poison who gets sick? These lawyers deliberately negotiated a settlement that undermines the very premise of the litigation. All that was very mysterious to me as a reporter. Now I understand, and I think I can do a better job of explaining why the rules might encourage that, where the flaws are in the whole process.
Right, right. You know, what I found is that you see a lot of cases settle, you know, after a significant amount of discovery takes place, and it's not only because they learn a lot about the case at that point, it's also because that on both sides, they've churned a lot of hours, and now they're going to be able to rationalize the fees that they're paid. And I think it does create its own momentum, and the public doesn't even realize that that's going on, because there's, even on the plaintiff side, there's this notion that, you know, settle the case on the first day and you get a third. In a lot of these big class action cases, that's not the case. It's based upon some multiple of some amount of time, and then you wind up getting paid, what was it, $35,000 an hour in a recent case?
Well, as someone told me with securities class actions, it's always mysterious to me why it takes 10 firms to prosecute a class action, and somebody explained it to me. Those hours are, quote, the coin of the realm. They swap hours amongst themselves so that they can march to the court and say, we expended X number of hours.
That's right.
And the attorneys then decide the pilot fish firms how many hours they get. And the court sanctions all this. Again, this is the job of journalists, is to bring this to light.
Yeah. And to be fair, on the defense side, I've also seen in these big class action cases, the defense firm will budget their year based upon not settling the case quickly.
It's the game theorists call it a repeated game context. Both sides know how it's going to be played, and they play it according to the rules that have developed over time. I mean, car accident litigation is the classic example. There's no reason for lawyers to even be involved in that. They all know how it's going to be settled. They know what the price is.
Right.
It's a repeated game.
Right. That's exactly right. You know, now, what are you seeing out there now? What kind of interesting cases and trends, and what are you going to be reporting on?
Well, I'm thinking about that. I obviously watched the Supreme Court, and we've got the big kahuna, which is Obamacare. I've pretty much gone with my old con law professor at Yale, Bill Eskridge, and decided to my own satisfaction that the conservatives on the court cannot with a straight face strike it down.
Really?
And I just don't see any way they can. It's not doctrinally possible. Conservatives properly say to the legislature, your job is to legislate. And it's not the judge of a judge really to decide whether something makes economic sense. And fundamentally that would be the argument against Obamacare. And furthermore, they've firmly upheld the necessary and proper clause, as Eskridge says, every comma and period Alito supported in a little notice case, I guess, 2 years ago. And so you add it all up, and it would be very hard for anyone but Thomas to just say, well, you know, we like the idea of the Congress legislating, but they went too far this time. There's not an easy way for them to reach that conclusion.
So even with the whole individual mandate question?
Yeah, it's the mandate is just a necessary and proper part of the overall legislative, you know, regulatory scheme. It's just one of the tools that's necessary to affect it. And Congress, in its infinite wisdom, decided they needed that. And it's a sort of a sideshow to say that, well, but you're making me buy something. Well, maybe not at the federal level, but certainly everybody has to buy car insurance pursuant to state laws. And you can say, well, the states have plenary power. Well, they do, but the overall philosophy is the same. And I think that Congress can make you buy something if they want to, if it's part of a larger scheme that they've fully debated and aired in public. So
right,
I think it's going to go down. I'm trying to think of other cases that we had the GPS case, which was intriguing to me.
Right.
Because I think that Scalia found a clever way, and I would not have known this without my wonderful Yale professors. Scalia found a wonderful way to basically dodge the question and avoid it for another day, saying that simply attaching the GPS unit to the car was an invasion of their property. Well, that's not going to work long term. You know, what about cameras on street corners and smart software that can identify a car? You program it and say, I want to know where a gray car with license plate ending in G is at all times of the day and night. Pretty soon, computers will be able to do that. And so you need the GPS unit. Now what? So that one's going to come back, and that will be an interesting, that, you know, that case will bubble back up to the Supreme Court again.
Yeah.
Scalia came up with reasoning that Sotomayor, it shows you what a careful, methodical legal mind Sotomayor has, which is what we were told, that mm-hmm. don't expect a knee-jerk liberal. She's much more methodical than that, and I think she showed that in this case where she said, Scalia, you made a good point. I don't want to concede the larger points of the sort of the broader ideas of what a search is, but I'll buy your argument here, and that ends the case. So
right, right.
She kind of held her nose and signed off on it.
Right.
These are going to keep coming up. It's the courts struggling to deal with the limits of the government's ability to sort of monitor, you know, your comings and goings. And I think they're backing into the old concept of privacy, which the conservatives hate, of course.
Right.
They're going to get forced back into that corner again.
Into a zone of privacy, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. This has been absolutely great, and I hope you'll come back. We've run out of time.
Yeah, good fun.
Yeah, and it's great. Dan Fisher is a senior editor at Forbes who writes the Full Disclosure blog. Dan, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank our guests, lawyer and talk show legend Lionel, and Dan Fisher, senior editor for legal affairs at Forbes. I hope you'll join us next time in the Court of Public Opinion.
Thank you for listening to In the Court of Public Opinion with your host, Jim Haggerty. Please be sure to join us again next Tuesday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, 12 noon Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll see you next week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.